I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We're celebrating 23 years in business and just entering our 10th year of doing open line programs. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have our new 2017 open line format that comes with the launching of our brand new website. So if you want to see a cool website, go check out our homepage. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication event tab. And over the years, we have covered most topics you can possibly imagine or have questions about. So you can just put a topic in and browse through it. You can also find an archive of past topics for our open line program, too. And we have, again, 10 years of different topics. Our second book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon, or you can click on our book icon on our homepage. Plus, in 2018, planning ahead, we will have our third book out, Cracking the Team Building Code, will be available. And we have been asked for many, many years to offer skills testing. We now have it available. So once again, you can go on our website and check that out. For those of you that have worked with Lighthouse, you might have met Glenn Croy, who is our new senior consultant and COO for Lighthouse. Glenn has been a CEO for companies between 60 to 600 employees with a strong OD background. We're so glad to have Glenn as part of our team. If you haven't spoken with him yet, you will soon. Our topic today, which we want to jump right into, is what is captive medical insurance? Some people have heard of it. Some people haven't. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. I'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the very first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including interpersonal coaching, team building, stress management workshops, and much, much more. We have an office in Taiwan, so if you have an operation in Asia and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas of how to best work with a U.S.-based company, just let us know. Plus, very recently, we have an affiliate office in the United Kingdom, and we now offer coaching all throughout Europe, so Lighthouse is now officially global. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area that you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to you as many as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of the program, we'll open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. So you may want to write down two or three questions, again, that you can send in the chat box during our program or during the open line segment. I want to introduce our guest. Jeff, are you on at this point?
I am on.
There you are. Perfect. Welcome. We have Jeff Slay and Andrew Kai-Kendall. You did good, Andrew, huh?
Yeah, very good. I'm impressed.
I want to introduce our guest first. Jeff brings 25 years of employee benefits experience to clients, spanning both from consulting and insurance carrier sides of the business. As a partner in charge, he works with clients as a key strategist around all aspects of employee benefit programs. Jeff started his career at Aetna, where he won the Field Award for Management Excellence both years before venturing out to start a benefits-only firm. As the firm continued to grow and given their unique value proposition, the firm was rebranded and named Novia, Neo for New and Via for Way. Perfect for this economic environment. Given the innovations they were introducing to the market, this included developing and designing products specific to their clients using data analytics that very few mid-sized clients have access to or have the time to gather. And given the changing landscape, and his desire was to bring about new things, Jeff led Novia and the team in joining Woodward Sawyer. So we're very excited to have Jeff on our program today. Let me introduce Andrew. Andrew is an alternative risk specialist. His programs include self-insured participating, medical captive, and medium premium solutions. He helps clients understand their programs through advanced data analytics. His role spans partner relationships, identifying new opportunities to help clients control their costs immediately. And he's going to get into that because everyone knows in the medical area, we've got to control those costs. And bending the cost curve in the future, got to look ahead. He also keeps our staff educated to the theory and practice of alternative funding. With 22 years of industry experience, Andrew has written and renewed nearly every funding mechanism in the marketplace and has experience with individual policies up to 35,000 life, Taft-Hartley funds. Prior to joining Woodward Sawyer, Andrew held key alternative risk and consulting roles for Nuvia, which is now Woodward Sawyer, Bolton and Company, Andrani and Company, Benefit Solutions Company, Calco, Gallagher, and Near North. He also formerly served as COO for an insurance agency in Irvine. Andrew's professional affiliations include serving on boards for the British American Business Council in Orange County, founding member of the BABC Young Executives, and part of the Broker Advisory Council for multiple TPAs and medical management service organizations. Andrew holds a certificate in the self-funded specialist designation from the HCAA. I feel privileged to have Jeff and Andrew with us today. I want to welcome both of you, and at the end of our program today, we're going to begin registration for our next open line, which is entitled Revenue Planning in Time of Uncertainty. So Jeff and Andrew, welcome. The show is all yours.
Thank you very much, Dana. This is Andrew Kuykendall speaking, and you heard Jeff already. We're going to jump right in and start. How did we get here?
Talking about the history.
I
want to just make sure. You're cutting out a little bit, but you weren't earlier. So.
Uh-oh.
You're back. Here. That's perfect.
Okay, good. Then I'll stand right here. We're going to start with how did we get to here? And by here, we're talking about employee benefits in 2017. Just very briefly going through the history of how employers began the process of offering healthcare and then how it has morphed and moved forward. Many of you may be familiar with this already, but it was actually Kaiser Automobiles and Kaiser Steel that was originally on the West Coast most influential in creating employee benefit programs. This was with clinics and physicians on site at the major production facilities. There were other areas that had done this in one or two locations, but Kaiser being the large conglomerate they were, they really established a footprint, and it became a very valuable recruitment and retention tool for them.
Hey, Andrew,
so,
the phone's starting to cut out again, but before it was so perfect.
Yeah, okay. Well, here, let me try this.
Okay.
Well, let
me make sure we capture everything because it's such a needed topic for everybody, an important topic.
Yeah, are we a little better here?
Much better. Oh, that's perfect. Okay, we got it.
Okay. Well, we'll try here until it doesn't work. So with the history of Kaiser, that goes back even well before World War II. So, as it developed and became on-site care and for employees and families. And that led to what eventually became nearly the expectation that employers were going to address the healthcare needs of the employees and their families. There was a lot of legislation passed, and one of the key ones being ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, where it sort of codified this social contract and created the ability for employers to pay for their programs through the tax-advantaged status that we enjoy today with that. So really, it's been about 70, 80 years that we've been involved with this, and for the first 50 or 60, there were two ways to cover your employees. So now we're looking at what had happened more recently, call it the late 70s into the early 90s, managed care, or the three letters, HMO, health maintenance organizations, PPO, preferred provider organizations, POS, point of service. Now we have HDHPs, HSAs, MSAs, however you want to describe them. This was really born about by doctors creating what were called provider groups. You might have heard of IPAs, Independent Physician Associations, or healthcare groups, et cetera, et cetera. This was in response to the rise of the insurance companies. As the insurance companies were gaining membership in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they were then going to the markets to try to exert pressure and say, we are going to bring you 15,000 employee lives who are in your area, and we are going to direct them to you. In exchange for that, you need to reduce your charges by X or Y or Z percent. The providers were very excited about this at first, and then when 15,000 became 50,000, became 100,000 employees, the providers started to push back and say, you need to provide us more money or we're going to cut off access to you. And that was a very interesting, not necessarily a battle, but a little bit of an ebb and flow as we pushed through the 70s to about the early 2000s. And now it's still a struggle today, and we're seeing it as an example here in Southern California. A very large hospital system was just taken off of a very large insurer's network literally overnight as negotiations broke down. This is very upsetting. It disrupts employees. It disrupts medical procedures. It's very frustrating. So the control feels like it has been taken away from the employers and the employees. Feel like they're getting pushed or pulled by either the insurance company relationship or the provider relationship.
Actually, go back for a second. We have two questions, and another somebody just wrote in. Dan, as far as enlarging the slides on your screen, everyone's slides everyone's screens or systems are a little bit different, so I'm not sure how to do that. But if you want to print the slides out, you can go to the print icon and write on that. We do have two questions that came in, Andrew. Is employee count, this is the first question, is employee count the only determining factor?
I would never say that it is the only determining factor. There is a portion of it that is appropriate for certain size employers. If you are a very small employer, meaning, say, 8 to 15 employees, it can be very difficult to find reinsurance. It can be very difficult to find the financial security associated with some of these programs. As you get a little larger into that 50 and 100 space, it becomes, there are more of these package solutions available, and then once you grow into a larger entity, say 250 to upwards, it becomes a little bit easier. So it's not impossible, but it does change the barrier of entry. One of the things I've noticed most of all, and I think, Jeff, you may be able to touch on this a little bit as well, is the number of employees, the number of dependents, the nature of the industry, the location of your employees, all of that is part of the consideration. But the most success that I personally have seen in a self-funded program is when the employer and the employees understand what the program is, they're working together, and much more important than an industry or a location is people working hand-in-hand, communicating openly, and building a program that's valuable to the employees so the employees feel that it's valuable for them to help protect the employer.
Okay, great.
So I would say ideology trumps almost any other measure.
And one more question on this topic. If someone has a plan, the majority of the folks are on HMO, is that a problem?
It is not a problem. Of the groups that we have placed in the last 3 years, as an example, into the captive program that we are managing, every single one of them had HMO exposure. Some of them had very small, two or three or four people in the HMO. One of them had 100% of their people in the HMO. There are ways to create the plan design. An HMO is a funding mechanism more than a plan design. You can make an HMO look exactly like a PPO. You can make a PPO look exactly like an HMO. So it's just a matter of finding out that we've got the right physicians in the right area, finding out that we've got the right plan designs in place. So being in an HMO and going to a self-funded option is not a disqualifier at all. The one thing I will mention is if they are presently with Kaiser, Kaiser is a closed system. So if Kaiser does not do self-funding at the levels of employees that we're talking about here, So the biggest hurdle there would be that everybody would be required to change their position.
Okay. Thank you very much. Onward.
And away we go. Self-funding in the 2000s. A couple of things happened in the 2000s. It used to be back in the 80s and 90s that we wouldn't even look at a group unless it had about 2,500 employees. And then that got down to about 1,000 employees. And then it got down to about 500 employees. And then it got down to about 300. And now we are seeing groups in the teens that are considering self-funding. What has happened? Better underwriting, better data analytics, the opportunity to look at claims, have a more predictable pattern, and determine when it makes sense and what's realistic. More flexible limits. Speaking again about stop loss, I think most people understand the concept of stop loss. It's a high deductible policy where the employer pays for the first X amount of dollars of coverage for an employee, and then the stop loss policy pays the rest. Well, that first X amount of dollars can be as small as $10,000, or it can be as high as $2 million. So it's about finding the right risk appetite and finding the proper risk pricing for your population.
Question just
so,
came in.
Yeah.
Or, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, medical insurance captives are relatively new to this. The first ones that we can absolutely identify in this structure arose in 2007 for a series of nursing homes. It was using a property and casualty theory of aggregating similar risks and doing group underwriting to have a greater purchasing power. So using the P&C theory, but using it for medical benefits rather than a liability umbrella or even a workers' comp policy. There have been captives for medical insurance going all the way back to the teens and 20s, actually, but those were generally for very large companies, and those were quite often used as a tax-advantaged financing vehicle rather than as a way to manage costs. So rather than using it to affect the healthcare outcomes, it was being used to affect a balance sheet. With a very rich history of captive participation, a lot of that happens in the Caribbean. So we have groups available in Aruba, we have them available in the Caymans, we have them available in Bermuda, et cetera, et cetera. That's always one of the first questions that we get asked is, do we get to go down to Bermuda and spend 3 days playing golf? And the answer is absolutely, but you have to pay for it. Everything that we do is transacted in the United States by United States banks held in United States accounts. There is a transaction period in which the money moves offshore into the Caribbean, and this is specific to the captive that we're managing right now. There are other captives where this is not part of their process, but that enables us to get some very distinct tax advantages on the funds and allows us to build a structure in which we are able to reimburse well-performing companies in the event that there is money left over in the captive. So there's a lot of different ways you can structure, and there's a lot of different ways that you can participate. So it's always a good idea to make sure that you have your arms around some of the basics and know which questions to ask.
Perfect.
So how does this work? We had talked very briefly about that specific deductible where you, as the employer or plan sponsor, pay the first amount of the claims. And then our captive grouping, which is yourself and many other employers are getting together, are paying the unexpected claims. And then we will go to a reinsurance company and we will ask them to cover the truly catastrophic claims. To say it another way, you as the employer, you pay the expected costs. If we all just take a moment and think about over the last 5 years, I may have used somewhere between $0 in medical expenses and $100,000 in medical expenses. It doesn't matter, but it varies. But every year I go and get my physical. I've got a prescription or two that I'm taking. I take my son in to get his sports physical for his high school. My wife goes in She has a couple of office visits a year, so we can think about what our average costs are. Those are the expected costs. So that is what you, as the employer plan sponsor, are paying for, those expected costs. Now, let's say, as an example, my son breaks his arm, and now he requires surgery, and he has to spend 3 days in the hospital, and there's a lot going on. That is an unexpected cost. And so we, as each individual plan sponsor within the captive, are funding a pool of money that will pay for those unexpected costs. We are saying that accidents happen. We know that there is going to be a certain amount of healthcare activity that requires more funds than the employer deductible is. So we'll pay those out of the captive. That does two things, really. One, it gives us a bigger pool of money to pay from. And two, instead of trying to figure out how many accidents are going to happen on 100 or 150 people enrolled in a plan, we're figuring out how many accidents are going to occur on 2,000 or 3,000 or 5,000 people on the plan. The larger the underwriting pool, the greater the predictability. The greater the predictability, the more advantageous the pricing. That's a fancy way of saying that you are buying your insurance based on 3,000 people enrolled with only 100 on your plan. So that's pretty exciting.
That is.
For me, at least.
That is. Well, say one more time. What's the difference between shock and catastrophic?
So a shock claim we generally associate with a single event. Let's say, for example, my son breaks his arm, or an appendicitis attack, something like that. A truly catastrophic claim is generally going to be something like, not to be too gory or anything, but we do see from time to time a skin graft can be incredibly expensive. God forbid somebody gets diagnosed with cancer and is now going in through chemotherapy. Those claims are generally going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars, not just $75,000 to $100,000 for a lengthy hospital stay, but quite literally hundreds of thousands of dollars. And with those claims, that's where we buy the reinsurance coverage. We know that there's going to be a certain amount of accidents or of those shock claims, but for the truly catastrophic, we want to make sure that nobody has to write a check at the end of the year to fund because somebody else in the captive ended up with a leukemia patient. So we are actually fully insuring the captive and everybody in it above $500,000. So if there's a $1 million claim, you're covered. You've already met your entire obligation, and we are never coming back and asking you to write a check. We're never coming to you mid-year and saying, oh, we have to adjust the premiums. You have guaranteed rates, and you have a guaranteed maximum cost.
Wow. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Moving on. I pushed the button, I swear.
Okay. Let me try pressing it. It's stuck. Okay. So the next slide is how does having the data help? It'll catch up with itself.
Okay. There it is. Yeah. The data is very interesting. We have a little saying around the office that be careful what you wish for. Everybody wants to know what their data tells them until they know it. You will find out a lot about your employees. If you have a very, very comfortable office, you probably already know whose children are seeking medical care or whose spouse is in a difficult situation. None of this is going to be shocking, and I'm not here to be salacious with it, but merely just to point out that you will find out that a significant portion of your population is pre-diabetic. And I would just assume that now, not because I know anything about your particular company, but overwhelmingly, every company we look at, a significant portion of their population is pre-diabetic. So with the data and knowing that there's that prediabetes disposition, we can develop a program where we get people in to see the doctor, where they can get the treatment that they need. They can get involved on the medications. They can get involved in activity programs that can even reverse some of the early stages of diabetes, and in the instance of type 2, completely avoid it. It's a whole lot easier to pay for insulin strips. Long-term consequence of diabetes, which can be up to and including an amputation. Same thing. We would much rather pay $15 a month for high blood pressure pills than to pay $75,000 for double bypass. So that is the opportunity for us to identify where do we have employees in need and what type of programs can we provide to them that will help them remain healthy and productive and hopefully continue to do so in a very, very long-term way. One of the things we've seen about this, we were chatting very briefly at the very beginning about lifestyles, about how people have different wants and needs and desires. Within our program, we have employers who absolutely love acupuncture and chiropractic, and they have created benefits at very low copays with unlimited visits. We also have employers in the exact same captive program who will not pay for it at all. It's not part of their cultural identity. It's not part of the benefit that their employees want. Another great way to do this is to create something that we technically call steerage. What's the difference between emergency visit versus urgent care? I can tell you right now, on average in Southern California, an emergency room visit is $800 per hour. An urgent care visit is $220, period. So by having the data, if we can learn that there are people who are overusing the emergency room and we can steer them to urgent care when appropriate, we can save thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars a year in claims costs just by letting people know that the emergency room is, they're going to pay $200 to visit the emergency room or $40 to visit the urgent care. So the data accomplishes many different aspects. It gives us an opportunity to form the plan to what's important to our employees. It allows us to see where our money is being spent. And it also gives us a chance to really look forward and say, here's a chance for us to attack certain diseases, whether it's cardiac, whether it's diabetes, whether it's obesity. How can we intertwine that with our corporate culture to keep our people happy and healthy?
All right.
So, this sounds fantastic. How come everybody in the world isn't doing this? Well, there's volatility in this. At the very beginning of the program, you don't know how many people are going to the emergency room on a daily basis. You don't know how many people have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. You may not know who's 5 minutes away from a heart attack. Or conversely, you may have an entire office filled with triathletes. But there's always that unknown risk. There's always that question of where do we fit in the risk profile? And that's where going through the underwriting helps. We talked about if there is an employee size or a location or as an example, a particular industry that fits in better. All of that does go into the underwriting puzzle, but it's not an automatic win or an automatic loss. You need to understand what your risk tolerance as a company is. We will come to you. We will show you exactly what your maximum cost is, but it should be and historically is going to be a little bit more than your fully insured plan. If everything runs well or everything runs normal even, it should be less than your current fully insured program. Are you comfortable? Can you accept the risk that things don't run well that year? And that's where communication is really key between yourself and the consultant, understanding the risk involved, understanding where the money's going, understanding when it comes back to you, and really understanding the dynamics of the program. There is some education up front. A lot of communication is the key. And like we talked about, it is the ideology. Are you willing to go to employees and say, hey, we're going to raise the ER copay from $100 to $250, and we're going to drop the urgent care copay from $100 to $40. By the way, every single employee in a payroll stuffer in a shift change meeting and on the front door every day, you now get to see that these are the 8 urgent cares that are closest to our office. So there is some communication involved. There's the action of the plan to keep the employees understanding what's being asked of them and understanding as well what your risk is on the side. So those are really the key volatility points, is getting the employees to understand how they can be better consumers and helping you understand what your total cost might be.
Andrew, a question came in. Does this require more work than my current program from the C-suite or from HR?
I will say that, that there is the education component, so yes. There will be some new forms that you're going to see. There's going to be some new communication that you may not have seen before with your fully insured program. But we're not talking about 10 to 20 hours a week of additional commitment. I think within the C-suite, it's just a matter of becoming comfortable with the risk and understanding the financial mechanics of the program. And with HR, it's the opportunity for them to truly customize the benefits, what's important to your employees. So we're looking at a program rather than saying, here's what's offered by the insurer, and we're saying, what do we want to offer to our employees? So there's a little bit more involved there. Once the plan is up and running, probably 1 to 2 hours a month additional, and that's just to review the claims reports. Otherwise, at the employee level, we're still communicating the same during open enrollments. We're still providing the same benefits information. We're still helping everybody out there. There's a little bit more around the financial side, but it's certainly not a large commitment.
This is Jeff Slay. So you're really not looking at any sort of meaningful time, and it's not like we're going to come out and tell you you have to make up the benefits or the plan designs from scratch. We'll look at what you currently have and make recommendations based on the data and information to try to match your benefits. And then really, as Andrew said, once it's set up and running, it's probably 4 to 6 hours than a traditional insurance plan. But after that, you're looking at an hour, 2 hours maximum a month to review your claims information and the data. You don't have to review it, but most of our clients want to review it so they know how the plan's running.
Perfect. And out of curiosity, we were talking earlier about using captive insurance as a tool for recruitment and retention. So let's say the company saves significant dollars by going through this program. Is any of that provided back to the employees as, thank you so much, we're able to keep our costs down, we're not having to pass that along to you guys or raise it? How does that work?
This is Jeff Slay again. We have one client that has been able to hold their costs flat for 5 years, and obviously that has been a huge win in that they haven't had to increase contributions to employees on to have insurance. And then what we typically find in a lot of fully insured clients is, you know, maybe their global budget for pay raises is 3% or 4%, but yet they're getting an increase in what they have to pay for health insurance that's the same or more. And so when they look at their net paycheck, it actually sometimes can go down because the insurance cost increased more than what their pay increase was. So each client goes differently. And then also from a wellness component, it's in the employer and the employee's best interest to encourage people to be healthy. So we often structure things in such a way that if people, you know, exercise regularly or they do other wellness components, taking their meds on a regular basis, et cetera, then their deductibles or their amount that they pay for insurance is lowered as well.
Ooh, okay. Well, one more question. We'll go to the next slide. Thank you, Jeff. The person attending is asking for a few examples of the employer risks.
Yeah, there's really two ways to answer that question. There's the known and the unknown. Quite often you can look out across your workforce, and again, I'm picking diabetes straight out of the hat here, but you may look at your workforce and you may see that there's a certain expectation that you're going to have a lot of that. Maybe it's a very sedentary workforce. Maybe there's some, just anything about this. Maybe you hear it at the water cooler, whatever it will be. That will be part of the underwriting process, is looking at the information we do have available and seeing what's going on. I will tell you this, your fully insured carrier right now knows exactly how many pre-diabetics and active diabetics are in your population, and that's already being reflected in your healthcare costs. So it's not that we're really going crazy trying to identify, and we aren't really seeking out, and we are not, in our program, we do not ask individual employee level questions. There are some who will, and based upon that employee level underwriting, you can get some very aggressive quotes, but you also run the risk of being completely declined of the opportunity to participate. So what we're looking at is, what information do we have? What do we know to be fact? And if we know that diabetics in general have a claims cost of 150% higher than a quote unquote standard claims cost, we're going to price for that. But as we mentioned, your fully insured carrier already has made that pricing. So you're not going to see these quotes come in at 80% higher. They're going to be a fairly standard. We generally see plus or minus 5 to 10%.
And then
unknown risk.
From a global level, when we're looking at an employer level, typically where it makes sense is where the maximum cost in the captive program is 5, 6% higher than what the fully insured premium is. But when we run the expected cost, we see that the potential savings is 12 to 18% below what the fully insured cost is. So worst case scenario, the employer might pay 5% more than had they been fully insured if everything goes horrible. But if things run according to plan, then they'll typically see an 8 to 18% savings. Also keep in mind that part of the savings under healthcare reform, there's about 5 to 6% that we pay in taxes, premium taxes, healthcare reform taxes, et cetera. In the captive model, a good 60 to 80% of the overall cost is not subject to those taxes. So we typically see a 3 to 5.5% savings just in the reduction of not having to pay those taxes.
Wow. Thank you very much.
And then just very briefly, a very quick example of an unexpected risk. Plan starts in January. In March, very exciting news, somebody is pregnant. They give birth to preemie quadruplets who spend 9 months in the intensive care unit. This is a little bit hyperbole, but a little bit of a real case scenario. So now we've got a bill for $4 million for four kids who spent 9 months in the neonatal ICU. You as the employer are responsible for your stop-loss deductible, whether it's $10,000, $25,000, $50,000, whatever's appropriate for you, for the mother only. So there's a lot of protections built in. Now going forward, if we know there's going to be a lot of expense associated with your group as a whole, you should expect that since we are asking you, the plan sponsor, to pay the cost that we know about, if we know that you're going to be a higher risk or have a higher expectation of claims, you can expect to see that reflected in your renewals. And we'll have the data to support it and help you manage through that process.
So translation in plain English, each individual in your company and or spouse and or child, they're set a specific amount that's the maximum that you, the employer, will pay. That may be $10,000, it may be $50,000. So you as the employer would, let's say it's a $50,000 specific stop loss in the preemie twins instance where there's four of them, you would be responsible for $50,000 for each of the four twins, but after that, the insurance carrier completely pays for anything above and beyond the $50,000 per individual.
So that's part of the multiple protections that we build in for this. And that's something that, like we said, we want to pay for what we expect, we want to be prepared for the shock claims, but we are going to provide that financial protection for the truly catastrophic cost. Getting back, just very briefly, touching more on this financial stability, that captive layer, because we're underwriting at 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 employees instead of 50 or 100 or 150 employees, we're much more predictable, and predictable means a lower cost basis to purchase the insurance. And you may have a great year, and next year you may have a horrible year, but you are 50 or 100 or 150 employees out of 3,000. It's not going to devastate you financially because the captive layer smooths out those difficult years. You are paying for your actual experience. I have this conversation on a weekly basis, it seems. The conversation always comes up of, well, why am I paying for somebody else's sick employees? Well, this is where you get to see your actual experience, and you get to see where your costs are being driven from, and you have the ability to help influence those costs. Very long story short, the program we're running right now lasts 7 years. This is across all employers. This is across over the 7 years, but we are running at a little bit, a hair under 3% increase year over year on insurance renewals. As Jeff mentioned, we do have one group that is at zero. Largest increase we have delivered in the last 3 years was at 11%, and that was because that group had identified over the course of the year many, many large claimants. We were able to find specific areas and programs that would help those claimants. And even though they had an 11% renewal cost as a projection, by controlling their claims, they were actually able to only pay 3% more over the previous year. Having the information gave them the ability to influence the claims, lowering the claims cost, lowered their overall cost. So who is the best fit for this? We've talked about ideology. I do think that a stable workforce, turnover, however you define stable, the reason being is we want to have that, the ability to be predictable. We want to know if we are bringing in 60, 70% new employees over the course of the year, we don't know how many of them may have premium quadruplets, as an example. But if we do have a relatively stable workforce, whether you count that as 5% turnover or 35% turnover, as long as we have some confidence that we know what our employee population is going to look like, that's a very good to look at this and consider. The second one, significant employer contribution. This one I feel is very valuable twofold. One, we want as much of your workforce participating in the program as possible. Why? The larger the risk, the more predictable the risk. The more people we have on the plan, the better we are at predicting the cost. Also, the more people we have on the plan, the greater opportunity for you to influence care and receive savings and the dividend back at the end of the year. Since you are making the large contribution, you are getting back a larger dividend. And what we find is a stable workforce that has a significant employer contribution, yeah, they're very much an engaged workforce. They enjoy working where they work. They want to keep working where they work, and they feel very good about where they are, and they are willing to pick up that payroll stuffer and see where the urgent care is. They're willing to hear you talk in an open enrollment meeting about why we want to make sure people are focusing on generic medication. So if you can fit one or two or three of these boxes, it might be a conversation worth having.
Who isn't a good fit?
In general, it's going to come back to the predictability aspect. If we have a lot of seasonal or a very high turnover, that makes it very difficult to be predictable. If we have mostly because of COBRA participation and because we don't know who's coming in or going out of that door. So anything over 100% turnover, I might recommend you table it until the next year.
Okay. We're going to our last slide, then we're going to open up the line for questions.
Yeah, and you know what? Is this right for me? I don't know that yet. We do know that there are companies that have embraced this as small as 35. We have companies in our program as large as 800. There are a lot of things you need to understand. Be honest with yourself. Understand your risk tolerance. Understand your culture and where you want your employees to be, and are they wanting to come with you? And most importantly, start a dialogue. Work with your consultants. Know what's available to you. Get your arms around the process and really feel confident before you go forward here. It's a different way of looking at healthcare. And we have such an established system in place right now that it's very easy to accept what we see year over year over year. So anytime we look at something a little different, we want to make sure that our employer groups have that information, have that education, and feel good about what they're doing. So be honest with yourself, be honest with your consultants. Make sure you're asking questions and ask them 5, 10, 20 times in a row until you're comfortable that you understand the answers that are coming back to you. And really, quite often we're hearing it's the second or third highest cost is the employee benefits package. So you don't want to jump into this just to see what happens. You want to make sure you feel good about the program, feel good about the people that you're working with, and most importantly, that your employees are going to do well under this type of a program.
And one of our clients, I'm not going to name them, they took a significant amount of time researching with you. How long, do you remember how long that took?
Oh, boy, what was that, 14, 15 months?
Yeah, that's what I thought. So you guys did a phenomenal job of preparing them and showing them the data and more data and then more data after that. And when everybody felt comfortable, then they decided to pull the trigger at that point. But they were at the comfort level, just like you were talking about, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. And we laugh about it internally. You know, we smile and we say people either buy in 90 days. It's either in 3 months or in 3 years. We're never interested in pushing anybody. This is a very big decision. We want to make sure people are comfortable. They feel that they have the education they need. In that particular instance, we were in contact frequently. So we knew that there was a lot of interest. And once they were comfortable and felt that it was appropriate, we were ready to go.
And what really caught my eye on this was first of all, the savings that can take place for a company that hits the bottom line. But also the employee engagement, the retention, and the recruitment function for offering benefits that can be much better than others are offering, and if it's designed a certain way for that market. But that's why I wanted to have you guys on Open Line, because I thought it would be a great thing to share with other people, because it's a lot of people don't know about it, or they're not familiar with it, or maybe they've heard some stories, but they don't know if it's right or wrong for them, and you guys actually take the time to really go through and drill into it.
And that's one of the very nice things, is that we are not subject in this program to whatever the insurance company deems is the flavor of the week, or you only get chocolate, vanilla, or strawberry, and if you want sprinkles, you can't have it. We can literally custom design what the benefits are down to 35 employees or 150 employees, so you're not stuck with what just the insurance company provides or offers.
That's phenomenal. Any other thoughts that you guys want to share before we open up the line?
I just want to thank you. This is something we really believe in. We've had great success with it, and it is a different way of approaching it. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to hopefully somebody on the line is feeling that this might be of value to them. Go out, research, find out about this. This is fun stuff for me. I really like my job.
I want to thank you guys for being on the program. We're going to turn off the recording feature in just a minute, so then we'll open up the line for people to ask direct questions with Jeff and Andrew. I want to thank you guys for being on Open Line. Our next program is going to be on September 21st. The title is going to be Reviewing Revenue Planning in Uncertain Times, and you guys can be the first to sign up. For that. It's going to be a very popular program. Once again, Jeff, Andrew, you did a phenomenal job on this. If everyone could please stand by, then we'll open up the line. What I would ask of everybody that's attending, if you could please put your phone on mute, and then if you have a question for Jeff or Andrew, unmute your phone, but please don't put it on hold, because then we'll get to hear your hold music. All righty? So we'll be back in just 1 second here. Please hold.